So then we begin this short series that I've entitled Call the Sabbath a Delight, based as we saw then in Isaiah chapter 58 in that statement there. In recent decades, perhaps through much of the 20th century in evangelical Christianity, then apologetics has been quite a big industry. You don't read much about apologetics in earlier Christian era. It's something that's relatively recent. Apologetics in then this modern, more technical sense of explaining and defending our faith in the wider world, in our society, why we live as we do and so on, and why then we practice and live differently from the people around and about us in our culture. And specific hot button issues, of course, come up in this: abortion, sex education and so on. And evangelicals have been diligent then in countercultural responses in the use of apologetics to explain and defend our faith. Yet there's a huge elephant in the room, isn't there? There's a huge elephant in the room of modern evangelical apologetics, and that elephant is the Sabbath. Because for centuries then, our evangelical forefathers kept the fourth commandment. They honoured the Lord by keeping his Sabbath day. And yet, by and large, today in our society, when you look at the Christians around and about us, when you look at the practice of the churches around and about us, they do not. Because what we've seen is a kind of reverse apologetics in the 20th century. Instead of evangelical Christians fighting against the cultural pressure to treat the Sabbath day like every other day and going to the scriptures and explaining why we lived, or our forefathers lived, to honour the Sabbath day and keep it holy and so on, instead we find evangelicals by and large explaining why our society is right, why our forefathers were wrong, and why the Bible apparently doesn't teach that we should be keeping the Sabbath day. And I think there's a tragedy for modern evangelicalism. And it's why then I was motivated to preach this short series on the Sabbath. So this evening then we will begin with the basics by reminding ourselves that the Sabbath then is established in creation and established in us as human beings. That the Sabbath then is not actually something for evangelicals specifically. It isn't something for Christians specifically. It is something for all human beings, in all times, in all places, because it is built into the creation order. It is built into who we are as human beings. And so this evening there are two main points, if you want to call them those. There is the fact that the Sabbath is what's called a creation ordinance. And there is the fact the Sabbath is built into us as image bearers of God. So first of all then, the Sabbath then as a creation ordinance. That is, it is something that was ordained in creation itself. Marriage and work are usually said to be the other creation ordinances that, like the Sabbath, are for all human beings, in all times, in all places, because they are part of what we read here in the opening of the Bible in creation, as we have it through the first couple of chapters in Genesis. So here then, we read about the Sabbath as an ordinance, a creation ordinance, didn't we, in chapter 2 in the first three verses. We've read the pattern that is stipulated there, that God created in 6 days, and then on the seventh day he rested. And so, verse 3 of chapter 2, so God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done. So the Lord himself there, he makes the whole universe in 6 days. Not in 2 days, not in 10 days, not in 100 days, in 6 days. And then he rests. And clearly, God doesn't rest because he was tired. He doesn't rest because he needed a, as it were, physical or a spiritual rest. His rest was a rest of the pleasure of a workman who has completed his work. It is the pleasure of a craftsman who has completed his piece of craftsmanship, who sits back and enjoys what he has done, who takes pleasure in his handiwork. This is made explicit for us here a little later in the Bible, in Exodus 31 and verse 17, where we read, "In 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." God's rest is a refreshing rest. It is a joyful rest. It is a rest in which God himself takes pleasure in his created handiwork. And it's fundamental then to the Sabbath as we approach it, that we see it in this positive way. That we see it as Isaiah preached it there in Isaiah 58. That the Sabbath is a good thing. It's a delightful thing. It was a delightful thing for God himself to work for 6 days and then to enjoy his seventh day of rest. We read here then in chapter 2 and verse 3 of Genesis then that God made it a holy day. That is, God set the day apart. He sets it apart for man to live for himself, that is, for God. It's a holiness in Scripture is always setting apart for God. Things are set apart for the Lord's service. The Sabbath itself then is set apart for the benefit of human beings, to be lived out and enjoyed for human beings. There is a seventh day, a pattern of 6 and 1 that's established, with the seventh then being, in imitation of God, a day set apart, holy, consecrated to God. And at the same time then, a blessing. God blesses the seventh day. Blessing then in Scripture is for creatures. It's for living things, especially human beings. I guess the phrase we're most familiar with is in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," and so on. Blessings are for people. Blessing then is for human beings. The Sabbath itself as a block of time isn't capable, as it were, of receiving blessing, but it's capable of being a blessing for us when we set that day apart for the Lord. The Sabbath is a period of time set apart, it's holy, and it's set apart to be a blessing, a good thing for us as human beings, because of course it's based then on that pattern of 6 and 1 for God himself, who for himself it was a blessing, a good thing. He was refreshed and rejoiced in his creation handiwork. So we see then here the Sabbath, the pattern of the Christian Sabbath, we call it today, going back to the very beginning of creation. It's a creation ordinance. Now, sometimes people raise an objection to this teaching that the Sabbath is rooted in creation. They will say, well, you know, it doesn't quite say what you're saying there, Alan. It doesn't spell it out as a command. It doesn't say it's an ordinance. It doesn't say it in that way. Aren't you reading too much into what's going on here? These statements, aren't you over-interpreting them? Well, it's part of the nature, actually, of these opening chapters of Genesis that they're really densely packed with teaching. That there are many statements in these opening chapters of Genesis into which a huge amount of material is compressed, and from which we legitimately unpack a lot of truth. This is one example. Another is further forward in chapter 2, verse 24, isn't it? Again and again, we go to this about marriage. We say, here we have marriage as a creation ordinance. Here we have the fact that marriage is for human beings between one man and one woman and so on and so on. But you could say the same thing, couldn't you? When you read Genesis 2, 24, you could say, well, hang on, aren't you overinterpreting this to derive all this sexual morality from this verse? Aren't you overinterpreting this to say everything you say about marriage and divorce from this verse? But it's the nature of this material here that it is densely packed. We know we're not overinterpreting Genesis 2:24 because Jesus refers to this, doesn't he, to teach about marriage and divorce. Jesus draws an immense amount of truth out of what's packed into this verse here. As does the Apostle Paul. And Jesus, as we'll see, draws the same truth out of Genesis 2 verse 3 about the Sabbath. So it's quite legitimate to read and to interpret, to draw out from what's packed into this, everything that I've been saying, that the Sabbath is established in creation as a day to be set apart, a holy day for God, and a blessing for us as we do that. But then again, if you turn forward to chapter 16 of the book of Exodus chapter 16, then we find in Exodus 16 that the Sabbath is already something established for the Israelites. Now, we're obviously not going to read through this whole chapter. Please do so later. And you'll see that as you read through this chapter, where the Lord brings manna to Israel for the first time. The Israelites have been grumbling after they've come out from Egypt. They're grumbling about being thirsty and hungry and so on. And so the Lord says that he's going to send them food. But he sends them food in a special way, doesn't he? He sends them food for 6 days and not on the seventh day. And when you read this chapter, God doesn't say, now I'm going to do a new thing. Here's a new idea for you. I'm going to start something new here with the 6 days and a one-day pattern. Of course he doesn't do that, because the 6 days of work and the one day of rest is already known to the Israelites. Exodus 16 verse 4 then we read, you know, behold, I'm about to rain this bread from heaven, the manna then, as it's called later. Behold, I'm about to rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them to know whether they will walk in my law. What law is this? And then on the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it'll be twice as much as they gather daily. Why the sixth day do they do that? Because they know that on the seventh day, it's to be a different day. It's a day that's set apart from God. They know this already before Mount Sinai. And then again, a little later in Exodus 16, in verses 27 and 28, we read, on the seventh day, some of the people went out to Galilee, but they found none. No manna, that is. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? Now, if, as is claimed, the Sabbath was an unknown thing before this and it wasn't established in creation, how can the Lord then say to them, how long will you keep breaking this law? How long will you break my commandments and my laws? Well, they would surely say, what are you talking about, the Lord? You've only just given us this. Because he hadn't just given it. They'd already been Sabbath breaking before Exodus 16. They'd already been breaking the Lord's Sabbath commandment before it became formally a Sabbath commandment. So we see then from Exodus 16 evidence that the Sabbath was built into creation as an ordinance. And then, of course, a little further on in Exodus chapter 20 at Mount Sinai, much more famously, we see this again, don't we? We see it as it's now stated for us, and as we perhaps most of us know it, in what's called the fourth commandment, Exodus chapter 20, there in the fourth commandment from verses 8 to 11, to remember the Sabbath day and so on. Remember the Sabbath day, again meaning something that you know from the past. You remember what was in the past. I know there's a claim that you can try and be told to remember something for the future, and that is true, but that's not usually how we remember it. remember, normally points backward, and it explicitly does here, of course, because verse 11 points back to creation. Why remember this 6 days and one day pattern? Why rest on the seventh day? Because in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy, explicitly pointing back to what was established in creation. So yes, the fourth commandment here is part of the covenant at Mount Sinai with Israel. But the Sabbath itself was already established in creation. It is a creation ordinance, a blessing then, not just for Israel, but a blessing that was to be a blessing for all mankind. And then, as I said, Jesus supports this, doesn't he? Jesus supports the interpretation that we have just been considering as the natural reading of Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. Now, we'll consider, my plan is, in God willing, in the final sermon in this series, to look in a much greater length, much greater depth, at Jesus' teaching on the Sabbath. Because you'll often hear evangelicals saying Jesus kind of abolished the Sabbath, Jesus didn't support the Sabbath, and so on. And that is completely wrong. And we'll see that when we read Jesus' teaching and consider it at length later. Here, I just want to quickly observe that Jesus teaches the Sabbath as a creation ordinance. So there are many Sabbath confrontations that you read of in the Gospels, aren't there, between Jesus and the Pharisees and the other religious leaders. There are major ones that we'll consider at length in what we have in Matthew 12, Mark 2, and the same passage in Luke, where we have a confrontation. As you remember, the disciples went through the cornfields and plucked ears of corn, and then afterwards Jesus heals the man with the withered hand. And there's a confrontation there in which Jesus argues at length and justifies at length why he and his disciples are honouring and keeping the Sabbath. Because Jesus kept the Sabbath diligently. He honoured the Lord in all his commandments, including Sabbath obedience. But remember now, in all these confrontations, Jesus is given a great opportunity, isn't he, to say, when the Pharisees come to him and say, why are your disciples picking the corn on the day? Here now Jesus could, whilst refuting them, also have said, but in the new covenant era, there isn't going to be a Sabbath anymore. But of course Jesus never said that. He said it in relation to the cleanliness code, didn't he? You remember how Jesus, when he talked about outward and inward cleanness, it's what comes out of the heart that really pollutes a man. It's that sin. It's not all this outward Levitical cleanliness stuff. And Mark says to us explicitly then, here Jesus was saying that all foods are clean. He was abolishing the cleanliness code. He was abolishing all that teaching in Leviticus. In the same way, Jesus abolished temple worship, that is worship at the temple in Jerusalem with all the sacrifices, didn't he? In Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, he says how that is going to be destroyed and all the worship with it will end. So Jesus wasn't averse to saying in his ministry that key parts of Old Testament worship were going to finish with the new covenant. He said it for the cleanliness code. He said it for the sacrificial worship system based in the temple. But in all his confrontations over the Sabbath, he never said it. Which I think is highly significant. But we're not left with just, as it were, an argument from silence, cogent though I think that is here. Jesus himself in Mark chapter 2 and verse 27, in this confrontation then with the Pharisees, he said, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. That statement Jesus is taking us back, as he did so often in marriage, to Genesis. He's taking us back here to Genesis 2 verse 3, isn't he? The Sabbath was made, that is created, for man, for the benefit, for the blessing of man, for human beings. Jesus is going back to creation And he's saying, look at the order. The Pharisees, remember, they made the Sabbath a burden. They invented hundreds of petty rules and regulations, and they made the Sabbath an immense burden on people. As if Jesus is saying, you know, the Sabbath was made first as the big thing, and then human beings were enslaved to the Sabbath afterwards. As if human beings were created later for the benefit of the Sabbath. That was a Pharisaical approach. It's completely the wrong way round, says Jesus. Look, read Genesis 1. Of course, it was human beings who were made first. And the Sabbath God established for the blessings, to be a blessing to all mankind. So the idea that Jesus didn't teach about the Sabbath is wrong. He explicitly agrees with what I've been arguing, what our evangelical forefathers argued, that the Sabbath is a creation ordinance, something established in creation for the benefit of all human beings, in all times, in all places. Jesus did not say the Sabbath was made for the Jews. If it were true that the fourth commandment begun the idea of the Sabbath, then Jesus should have said the Sabbath was made for Jews, shouldn't he? He should have said the Sabbath was made for Israel. But he doesn't. He doesn't go to Exodus 20. He goes to Genesis, the beginning, and says it was for all mankind, not just the Jews. A creation ordinance, then, Jesus himself explicitly affirms. So that's the first important truth for us to keep very clearly in mind. Not just for us as evangelicals, not just for Christians, not just for religious people, for all human beings, the Sabbath was established in creation. It's a creation ordinance. But secondly, we see it's for all human beings in all times and all places. Because we were made in God's image and therefore with God's law written on our hearts, in our human nature. So this time we're in, of course, the beginning again, Genesis chapter 1. And this time, of course, the statement's in verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Human beings, then, we are made as replicas of God. We are made as miniatures of God. We are made to be those who are like God, who bear his character. Of course, since the fall and sin and so on, that representation of God is horribly marred. But in creation, Adam and Eve were made perfect as image bearers, representatives of God, who would be like God morally, like God in the way in which they lived. Human beings are to be like God. We're to imitate his character as human beings because this is who we are, his image bearers. And so what is God like then? What is God like? What kind of character does God have? How do we know about God's character? Well, you might say that's a fine question for a psychiatrist to ask. Isn't a psychiatrist supposed to know these sorts of things? And I suppose I am supposed to be kind of expert in answering that kind of question. But, of course, you don't have to be an expert, do you, to answer that question. We have phrases like, you know, the preacher should practice what he preaches. And deeds speak louder than words, don't we? Because yes, somebody's words, their speech, tells us something important about them. It reveals something, but it's not the most reliable guide to somebody's character, is it? Somebody's behaviour, their deeds, their actions, are a much more reliable guide to the character of someone. So we know that God is a God of truth because of what we read in the Bible and how we find him acting in accordance with truth. He doesn't lie, he doesn't deceive, and so on. That's why we have a commandment that fits with that. We know that God is a faithful God who honours relationships because he proves it by his behaviour. Yes, he says it, but he also lives it, as it were. But then people will say, but this doesn't apply to the fourth commandment, does it? We know God's a truthful God. We know he's a God who loves life, and that's why we have the sixth commandment, and so on. But the fourth commandment doesn't work like that, doesn't it? What have we read? We've read that God creates in 6 days and rests on the seventh day. This is who he is. This is the kind of God he is. Sometimes I think people treat the fourth commandment as if it was somehow then separate from the character of God. The rest of the moral law, all the other commandments, we understand flow out from the character of God. But perhaps the fourth commandment, no, that's kind of arbitrary. God just made up this idea of 6 days of work and one day of rest. But on what basis would anybody make that claim that God just made it up in an arbitrary way? How would you justify that? Because the only time we learn of God working is in creation. God works in creation for 6 days and then he rests. There isn't another universe out there in which God worked for 100 days or something and rested. Or there isn't another universe out there in which God never rested somewhere. He's always working at it. Now, the only evidence we have for God's character in relation to the fourth commandment is here in Genesis 1 and the first 3 verses of chapter 2, where God creates in 6, works for 6, and rests for 1. This is who God is. This is the character of God. He's a God who works and rests. It's not, the Sabbath commandment is not independent of God's holy moral character. It's not arbitrary. And therefore, when we say as human beings, we are image bearers, we're to imitate God's character, we're to seek to be moral as God's moral, and that includes being Sabbath-keeping people, because God is a Sabbath-keeping God. That's who he is. And then relatedly, of course, to this teaching then in Genesis about us being the image bearers of God are those statements about the law being written on the heart. And the most well known would be in Romans chapter 2. You might like to turn forwards in the Bibles then to Romans chapter 2. Of course, the key verses, as many of you will know, are in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Let's read these verses together. Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. For when Gentiles who do not have the law, by nature do what the law requires, they're a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. That is the law given at Mount Sinai, written down. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. So here Paul says the law is written on the heart of human beings. This fits then, as we've seen, with us being created in God's image. And that therefore what the law Paul is talking about here is what's sometimes called the moral law. Now, just to, as an aside, it's important. When we talk about the moral law, yes, we're distinguishing from lots of other laws that God makes, like those laws of cleanliness and so on that Jesus abolished. But the moral law then is not exactly the same as the Ten Commandments. Okay, I use them again and again. You'll find me, I'm sure, using them interchangeably. And that's fine. Lots of people do that, and that's fine. Provided we don't think that the moral law is exactly the same as what was written on the two tablets of stone at Mount Sinai. Because at Mount Sinai, God wrote his moral law in a specific form as part of the old covenant. Now, it's probably true for you, and I'm almost certain it's true for me, that of all the sins I've done, I've never coveted my neighbour's donkey. That's in the law at Mount Sinai, isn't it? Because the law there was given for that specific situation. It's a specific iteration or writing of the moral law embedded within the old covenant for that people. The moral law itself, as it were, is in God. It can be written down in different ways. So Jesus summarizes it as two parts, doesn't he? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. At Mount Sinai, it's given us these 10 laws. Other teaching in the Bible breaks down each of those 10 laws into further laws, consistent with those two laws, consistent with the 10 laws, consistent then with the character of God. The moral law then is what's written on the heart of man, of every human being. But it's not to say, when we say this, when I say this in this series, not saying that what was written on man's heart was the 10 commandments as on the tablets of stone at Mount Sinai. Because that's sometimes a kind of petty way in which people deal with this. They say, well, are you actually saying that, you know, because you say that this, the fourth commandment of the Sabbath continues, that God wrote just what he wrote on those tablets of stone? And they give that impression. That's not the point. The moral law was expressed that way there. It goes back to who God is, ultimately. And that, it's part of the God's character, his morality, that is written into us. And so, yes, the Ten Commandments express that, and they are laws, and to break them is sin, but they're not the only way of expressing it. And we wouldn't break them in the same way as Israelites might. Okay, so the moral law is what Paul is talking about here. How do we know that? How can I say that? After all, as many of you know, law is used in different ways. It might mean the Pentateuch, it might mean the whole of the Old Testament, it might mean some smaller group of laws in Exodus and so on. Or it might mean the Ten Commandments, the moral law in that form. Well, we know that Paul's talking about the moral law because of the context. Back in chapter 1, Paul has been condemning the Gentiles for sin. Now, the issue then, of course, that people can say was, well, if sin is breaking the law, and the Gentiles don't have the Ten Commandments as given at Mount Sinai, how can they possibly be convicted of sin? Because they can't break laws. They've never had the laws. And Paul's saying, well, that's not true, because the laws are written on every human heart that they're breaking. They're guilty as sinners. And remember in Romans 2, 14 and 15, Paul says, you Gentiles. It's Gentiles explicitly saying you are guilty of sinning because you break the laws of God, the moral law written on your heart. What does he say this includes? What kind of wickedness? Chapter 1, verse 23, idolatry. Chapter 1, verse 24, sexual immorality. Chapter 1, verse 27, homosexuality. Chapter 1, verse 29, covetousness. Chapter 1, verse 29 again, envy and murder. 29 again, deceit. Verse 30, disobedience to parents. These you recognize as transgressions of the moral law, as written, stipulated in the Ten Commandments. These are breaking the law, God's moral law. Paul doesn't condemn them for not being circumcised. He doesn't condemn them for eating pork and so on, for eating meat with its blood and so on. There's nothing. He condemns them for what we all recognize are transgressions against God's holy moral law. Because that's what's written on the heart of every human being. That's why every human being is condemned as a sinner before God, even when they've never heard of these laws like you and I have, even when they never had a Bible. They are guilty for breaking the law of God, the moral law written on the heart. Now again, people have objections. They'll say, but ha-ha, there's no reference here to the fourth commandment, to the Sabbath, is there? or doesn't come and he doesn't mention Sabbath breaking. No, Paul doesn't mention Sabbath breaking, and he doesn't mention stealing, and he doesn't mention blasphemy either, if you to pick out two other of the Ten Commandments that are not mentioned in Paul's random coverage of sins of the Gentiles. And frequently when you read the so-called vice lists or sin lists in the New Testament, or you read such lists of Israelite transgressions, the Sabbath isn't mentioned. But that's not surprising, is it? Because what's always, almost always, I'm quite checked every single instance in the Bible, what's almost always mentioned is idolatry. The Gentiles here are condemned for their idolatry. Time and again, you read the prophets in the Old Testament, they run after the Baals, they run after the Ashtoreths, they worship all these non-gods. And they created gods or images of God out of blocks of wood and so on. It's transgressions of the first and second commandments that are mentioned again and again and again. And so I ask you now, how likely is it that people who were running off worshipping Zeus and Aphrodite are going to keep the Sabbath? How likely is it that your Old Testament Israelites who were worshipping the Baals and the Ashtoreths were at the same time faithful Sabbath keepers? And those who honoured God's name, keeping the third commandment whilst they trampled over the first two. I mean, the idea is ludicrous, isn't it? I mean, if you're trampling over the first two commandments, you can take it as read that the third and fourth commandments were broken as well, willy-nilly. We know they broke the fourth commandment as well because of passages like Isaiah, but Isaiah 58 that we read. But you see my point, you wouldn't expect the Sabbath to be mentioned really very much, because when people are idolatrous, they are going to be breaking the Sabbath. When they don't love and worship God, they're not going to be honouring his name and keeping the Sabbath. The third and fourth commandments are widely broken. They're always broken whenever the first and second commandments are transgressed. So the objection doesn't stand up. The objection does not stand up. So we see then that the Sabbath, this one day a week, was established in creation. Not just because it's written for us and reinforced, as we've seen in the Old Testament, but because Jesus himself confirmed that interpretation. And we see it also because we are made in the image of God, with his moral law written inside us to tell us what is right and wrong. And that moral law includes the Sabbath keeping, because that reflects the character of God as a Sabbath keeping God. And so just to conclude by coming back to where I began about the rampant Sabbath breaking in our society and among evangelicals today. It's a tragedy, isn't it? It's a tragedy for our society that every day is treated as the same, that people are made wage slaves running after more and more money, relationships broken, families divided, children neglected, all the horrible consequences that flow from not enjoying the Sabbath. It's a tragedy for our churches. We're increasingly, we see churches who just seem to want to gather quickly in the morning for a service and then get off home and do like everybody else, to get down to the sports ground, to get on the television and enjoy the sports programs like everybody else, to watch the evening drama of the moment, whatever it is on television. How damaging that is to churches, and how damaging it is to us, to human beings, to Christians who do not keep the Sabbath. Always in the Bible there are blessings and there are cursings, aren't there? If you dishonour the Lord by breaking his Sabbath, you forfeit the blessings, but you receive the cursings. You receive the misery and the sufferings and everything that flows from breaking God's laws. But those of us who love the Lord and want to honour him and rejoice in his Sabbath, we receive it as a blessing, don't we? That I can work for 6 days and I have no guilt then about doing no work on the Lord's day. My conscience is completely clear. I can relax and enjoy worshipping God, reading and praying and praising and meeting with his people. That's a rich blessing, isn't it? To gather together with the Lord's people and to do so as much as possible. To get apart then from all the horrible practices of the people we have to mingle with out there through the week. To rejoice in being able to gather together with people who share our love for the Lord, who are committed to honouring him. The Sabbath is a delight. And I hope we can all learn more and more to take our delight in it. Amen.